taken time to dress her before he took her away. Yet all her coats were in her room. Had it been too late for her to ever need a coat again? And why the backpack? Why the pillowcase? The owner of the house told Detectives Fonis and Dorman that he routinely changed all the locks on outer doors to the house when new tenants moved in. This might have been a prudent safeguard, save for the fact that the five girls had left an extra key in the mailbox on the front porch. Furthermore, both Linda and Marty had lost their keys and had duplicates made. Any man watching, waiting, aware that five women lived in the home could have charted their movements, seen them retrieving the extra key from the mailbox. Now, filled with dread, the remaining four tenants moved out of the greenhouse, and some young male friends moved in to monitor any strange activities. But what had happened had happened. The last peculiar incidents the other four girls could remember was that there had been three phone calls on the afternoon after Linda vanished. Each time they answered, they could hear only breathing on the other end, and then the line had gone dead. Every inch of the neighborhood was searched, all the dark, leafy ravines of nearby Ravenna Park, both by officers and by canine dogs. But Linda Ann Healy was gone, and the man who had taken her away had left no trace of himself, nothing. Not so much as a hair, a drop of blood or semen. He had either been very clever or very, very lucky. It was the kind of case that homicide detectives dread. On February 4th, a male voice called the police emergency number 911.
"Listen, and listen carefully. The person who attacked that girl on 8th last month and the person who took Linda Healy away are one and the same. He was outside both houses. He was seen."
"Who is calling?" the operator asked.
"No way are you going to get my name," the man answered, and hung up.
Both Linda's current and former boyfriends volunteered to take a lie detector test, and both passed without question. As the days and then weeks passed, it was painfully clear that Linda Ann Healy was dead, her body hidden so carefully that only her killer and God knew where she was. The Seattle Police Crime Lab had a pitifully short list of physical evidence items to work with. One white sheet, bloodstain, type A positive. One yellow pillow, bloodstained, type A positive. One short cream-colored nightgown with brown and blue flowered trim, bloodstained, type A positive. Area of bloodstain on white sheet shows distinct ribbed pattern at edges. This was all that remained of the vibrant girl who had bade goodnight to her friends on January 31st and walked away into oblivion. To solve a homicide, and Linda Healy's disappearance was surely a homicide, detectives must find some common threads, something linking the victim to the killer, a similar method of operation in a series of crimes, physical evidence, links between the victims themselves. Here they were stymied. There were no connections at all between Linda Healy and Joni Lenz, except that they had both been attacked as they slept in basement rooms in communal houses less than a mile apart. Joni had suffered head wounds, and from the blood pattern on Linda's pillow and the stains on her nightgown, it would seem that she, too, had been struck violently on the skull. But none of the residents of the two houses knew each other. They hadn't even attended the same classes. February slipped into March, and Linda didn't come home. Nor was there even one sighting of the possessions missing with her. The backpack, her peasant blouse, her old jeans with the funny triangular patch in the back, her two turquoise rings, distinctive round flat rings with tiny turquoise nuggets floating on the silver circles on top. Just two more quarters, and Linda would have graduated from the university, would have taken a job where she would have been of infinite help to the retarded children whose lives had not been blessed as hers had been, with brains, beauty, a loving and nurturing home. While Seattle police detectives wrestled with the inexplicable disappearance of Linda Ann Healy, Sheriff Don Redmond in Thurston County and his detectives were having problems of their own. A female student was missing from Evergreen State College, whose campus is just southwest of Olympia. Evergreen is a relatively new college in Washington, with great, soaring, precast concrete buildings rising improbably from the dense forest of fir trees. It is a school much maligned by traditional educators, because it eschews required courses, accepted grading scales, and embraces a do-your-own-thing philosophy. Students choose what they want to learn, everything from cartoon animation to ecology, and draw up contracts that they promise to fulfill each quarter for credit. Its detractors claim that a graduate of Evergreen has no real skills or educational background to offer an employer, calling it a toy college. Nevertheless, Evergreen attracts some of the brightest and the best. 19-year-old Donna Gail Manson was a typical Evergreen student, a highly intelligent girl who marched to a different drummer. Her father taught music in the Seattle Public Schools, and Donna shared his talent and interest in music. She was a flutist, expert enough to play in a symphony. With the news that a second young woman had undoubtedly come to harm within Thurston County, I drove once again to Olympia and conferred with Sheriff Redmond and Sergeant Paul Barclift. Barclift explained the circumstances of Donna's vanishing to me. On the rainy Tuesday night of March 12, 1974, Donna had planned to attend a jazz concert on campus. Her dormitory mates recalled that she'd changed clothes several times, studying her image in the mirror before she was satisfied with the red, orange, and green striped top, blue slacks, a fuzzy black maxi coat. She'd worn an oval brown agate ring and a Bulova wristwatch. And then she'd set out alone to walk to the concert shortly after 7 p.m.
"She was not seen at the concert," Redmond said. "She probably didn't get that far."
Linda Ann Healy and Catherine Mary Devine had been tall and willowy. Donna Manson was only 5 feet tall and weighed 100 pounds. The Thurston County detectives and Rod Merrim, chief security officer for Evergreen State College, were not notified that Donna was missing for 6 days. Donna's lifestyle was such that she often took off on a moment's notice, only to reappear with tales of a hitchhiking trip, sometimes to points as far away as Oregon. When the report on her absence came in from another student, it was only a please attempt to contact request. But the days passed with no word of her, and her disappearance took on an ominous tone. Barclift began to contact everyone who knew Donna, followed up every possible lead. He talked to her best friend, Teresa Olson, and her ex-roommate, Celia Dryden, and several other girls who had lived in the dormitory with her. Donna Manson, despite her IQ, had not been a good student. She had attended Green River Community College in Auburn before she'd come to Evergreen, and had entered with a cumulative 2.2 C+ grade point. She had chosen a rather broad curriculum, Portals, Personal Options Toward Effective Learning Skills. However, Donna had fallen behind even at Evergreen because she consistently stayed out all night, returning at dawn to ask Celia to cover for her in class, and then going to bed for most of the day. This had bothered Celia, as had Donna's obsession with death, magic, and alchemy. Donna had seemed to be weighed down with depression, and her constant scribblings about alchemy troubled her roommate, too. Celia had asked to be moved to another room shortly before Donna vanished. Alchemy is an ancient pseudoscience, the preparation of an elixir of longevity, any seemingly magical power or process of transmuting. Practiced first in ancient Egypt, it was not the curriculum that might be offered at a more conventional college.
"We thought she might have committed suicide," Barclift said, "but we had her writings evaluated by a psychiatrist, and he felt they were not particularly significant for a girl of that age. If she had been afraid of anything specific, he thought she would have written it down, and we didn't find anything like that in her writings."
The investigators had found several slips of paper in Donna's room. One listed Thought Power, Inc. A preliminary check by the detectives showed this to be a licensed business in Olympia, located in a neat older home. Seminars on positive thinking and mind discipline were held there. The owners had changed the name to the Institute of ESP just before Donna disappeared. Donna Manson had used marijuana almost daily, and her friends thought she might also have tried other drugs. She had dated 4 men. They were checked out, and all were cleared. Donna had hitchhiked to Oregon in November, but most of her trips away from campus were to visit friends in Selick, a tiny mining hamlet located along the road that led up to Issaquah and North Bend and then connected to the main freeway which wound over Snoqualmie Pass.
We checked with the people there, and they hadn't seen her since February 10th, Barcliffe said.
As caught up as she was in her search for what she termed that other world you can't explain, Donna had remained close to her parents. She had spent the weekend of February 23rd, 24th with them, had called them on March 9th, and written them a letter on March 10th. She'd been in good spirits and was planning a trip to the beach with her mother. Barcliffe drove me around the Evergreen campus. He pointed out the lights that stood next to the pathways, but the campus seemed to retain many elements of the original wilderness it had been. In spots, the winding paths disappeared into tunnels of lowering fir boughs, the forest primeval.
Most of the girls walk in pairs or groups after dark, he commented.
The campus was sodden with spring rains. It had been searched in a grid pattern by men and tracking dogs. If Donna was there, her body hidden in a morass of salal, Oregon grape, sword ferns, and deadfall firs, they would have found her. But Donna was gone, just as completely as Linda Healy was. The things she'd left behind in her room, her backpack, her flute, suitcases, all her clothing, even the camera she invariably carried, were turned over to her parents. In the end, the Thurston County investigators were left with Donna's writings on death and magic, and the x-rays they had obtained from her physician of her spine, left ankle, and left wrist. If they found her now, they feared it might be the only way to identify her. Chapter 8. During that spring of 1974, I had rented a houseboat in Seattle to use as an office, subletting the creaky little one-room structure that floated precariously on logs in Lake Union, a mile south of the university district. I was fully aware now that two college girls were missing, that Kathy Devine had been murdered, and I was beginning to sense that police felt a pattern was emerging, but the public remained unaware. Seattle averages about 60 homicides a year. King County vacillates from 2 or 3 to a dozen annually, and Thurston County rarely exceeds 3. Not a bad percentage for areas highly populated, and things appeared to be normal. Tragic, but normal. My ex-husband had suffered a sudden grand mal epileptic seizure. His cancer had metastasized to the brain. He underwent surgery and was hospitalized for several weeks. My youngest daughter, Leslie, then 16, took a bus to Seattle every day after school to care for her father. She didn't think the nurses were attentive enough. I worried. She was so lovely, looked so much like the girls who were disappearing, and I was frightened to have her walk even half a block alone in the city. She was insistent that it was something she had to do, and I held my breath each day until she was home safe. I was experiencing the kind of dread that soon every parent in the area would feel. As a crime writer, I had seen too much violence, too much tragedy, and I saw suspicious men wherever I went. I have never been afraid for myself. But for my daughters, oh yes, for my daughters. I warned them so much that they finally accused me of getting paranoid. I gave up the houseboat. I didn't want to be that far away from my children, not even during the daytime hours. On April 17th, it happened again. This time, the girl who vanished was 120 miles away from Seattle, far across the looming Cascade Mountains that separate the verdant coastland of Washington from the arid wheat fields of the eastern half of the state. Susan Elaine Rancourt was a freshman at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, a rodeo town that has retained the flavor of the Old West. One of 6 children in a close family, Susan had been a cheerleader and homecoming queen in LeConnor Washington High School. She differed from the other missing girls in that she was a blonde with long hair, blue eyes. She had the sort of stunning figure that most teenage girls pray for, not to mention teenaged boys. Perhaps her early development had contributed to her shyness and eclipsed the fact that Susan had a superior, scientifically oriented intelligence. When the rest of her family moved to Anchorage, Alaska, it took courage on Susan's part to stay behind to attend college in Ellensburg. She'd known she'd have to pay most of her own way. With 5 other siblings to raise, her family just didn't have the money to foot all her college bills. The summer before her freshman year, Susan worked 2 full-time jobs, 7 days a week, to save money for tuition. She'd always known that her career would be in the field of medicine, and her high school grades, straight A's, and her college aptitude scores verified that she was a natural. At Ellensburg, Susan Rancourt was majoring in biology, still getting a straight 4.0, and working a full-time job in a nursing home. She was a young woman any family could be proud of. Where Linda Healy had been cautious and Donna Manson had been heedless of danger, Susan Rancourt was frankly afraid of the dark, of being out alone. She never went anywhere without her roommate after the sun had set. Never until the evening of April 17th. It had been a busy week for her. Midterm finals were being held, but she learned of an opportunity open for would-be dorm advisors. With that job, her expenses could be cut a great deal. Besides, it would give her a chance to meet more students, to break out of her self-imposed shell of shyness. So she took a chance. Susan was only 5'2" and weighed 120 pounds, but she was strong. She jogged every morning and she'd gone to karate classes. Perhaps she'd been foolish to think she couldn't protect herself on a crowded campus even if someone did approach her. At 8 o'clock that evening, she took a load of clothing to a washroom in one of the campus dorms and walked off to the advisors' meeting. The meeting was over at 9, and she planned to meet a friend to see a German film and then return to the laundromat to put her clothes in the dryer at 10 o'clock. But no one saw Susan after she left the meeting. Her friend waited and waited, and then finally went into the film alone, looking back toward the entrance several times for the familiar sight of Susan's figure. Susan's clothes remained in the washer until another student who needed to use it impatiently removed them and set them on a table where they were discovered a day later. Susan Rancourt's failure to return to her dorm was reported at once. Susan had a boyfriend, but he was far away at the University of Washington in Seattle, and she dated no one else. She just wasn't the type not to come home at night, and she surely wouldn't have missed a final exam. She'd never even skipped a class. Campus police officers noted down the outfit she'd worn when she had last been seen. Gray corduroy slacks, a short-sleeve yellow sweater, a yellow coat, and brown hush-puppy shoes. And then they attempted to retrace the route she would have taken from the advisors' meeting back to the dormitories a quarter mile away. The quickest and most common route led up the mall past a construction area, across a footbridge over a pond, and then under a railroad trestle near a student parking lot.
"If someone watched her, followed her, and meant to grab her," one officer commented, "it would have been here, under the trestle. It's dark as hell for about 20 feet.
But there should have been something left of Susan there. For one thing, she'd been carrying a folder full of loose papers that would have scattered in every direction in a struggle. And shy as she was, Susan Rancourt was a fighter, adept at karate. Her friends insisted that there was no way she would have given up quietly. Beyond that, the path back to Bartow Hall, where the film was being shown, was the route most students took. At 9 at night, there would have been steady, light traffic. Someone should have seen something unusual, but no one had. Susan had had only one physical imperfection. She was very nearsighted. On the night of April 17th, she had worn neither her glasses nor her contact lenses. She could have seen well enough to make her way around the campus, but she would have had to walk up quite close to someone to recognize them, and she might well have missed a subtle movement in the shadows beneath the trestle. With the disappearance of Susan Rancourt, other co-eds came forward with descriptions of incidents that had vaguely disturbed them. One girl said she'd talked to a tall, handsome man in his 20s outside the campus library on April 12th, a man who had one arm in a sling and a metal brace on his finger. He'd had trouble managing his armload of books and had dropped several.
"Finally, he asked me if I'd help him carry them to his car," she recalled.
The car, a Volkswagen Bug, was parked about 300 yards from the railroad trestle. She'd carried his books to the car and then noticed that the passenger seat was missing. Something, she couldn't even say what, had caused the hairs on the back of her neck to stand on end. Something about that missing seat. He seemed nice enough, and they talked about how he'd been injured skiing at Crystal Mountain,
but suddenly she just wanted to be away from him.
I put the books on the hood of his car and I ran.
A second girl told a story very like the first. She had met the man with an injured arm on the 17th and had carried some packages wrapped in butcher paper to his car for him.
Then he told me that he was having trouble getting it started and asked me to get in and try the ignition while he did something under the hood. I didn't know him. I didn't want to get in his car, and I just made some excuse about being in a hurry, and I left.
The son of an Oregon district attorney visiting on campus remembered seeing a tall man with his arm in a sling standing in front of Bartow Hall around 8:30 on the evening of the 17th. The reports didn't seem all that ominous. Anytime a crime or a disappearance occurs, ordinary incidents take on an importance for witnesses who want to help. The statements were typed, filed away, and the search for Susan Rancourt continued. In this case, as in many others, a minute detail would provide mute testimony to the fate of the missing girls. With Donna Manson, it had been her camera left behind. With Susan, it was her contact lenses and her glasses, glasses that she'd probably meant to carry with her to the movie on the night she vanished, and her dental floss. When her mother looked into her medicine cabinet and saw the dental floss, she felt her heart thud. She was such a creature of habit. She never went anywhere overnight without dental floss. Captain Herb Swindler, a massive bulldog of a cop, a veteran in homicide investigations, had taken over command of the Crimes Against Persons Unit of the Seattle Police Department in the spring of 1974. I had known Herb for 20 years. In 1954, he was a patrol officer who had responded first to a complaint of indecent liberties by the mother of a small girl in West Seattle, and I was the most rookie of policewomen who was called in to question the child. I'd been 21 then, and admittedly somewhat embarrassed at the questions I had to ask the little girl about the nice old man who boarded with the family. I remember how Herb teased me because I'd blushed, the standard razzing that new policewomen received. But he'd been gentle with the child, with her mother. He was a good cop and a thorough investigator, and he'd moved up rapidly through the ranks. Now the buck stopped in Herb's office. Most of the missing girls' cases had seemingly originated in Seattle, and he was wrestling day and night with the mysteries that seemed to have no clues, no answers. It was as if the man responsible was taunting the police, laughing at the ease with which he'd abducted the women, leaving no trace of himself. Swindler is a talkative man, and he needed a sounding board. I filled that need. He knew I wouldn't talk to anyone outside the department, knew I'd followed the cases as meticulously as any detective. Certainly I was a writer looking for the big story, but I was also the mother of two teenage daughters, and the horror of it all, the agony of the parents, kept me awake nights. He was confident I wouldn't publish a word until the time was right, if ever. During those months of 1974, I talked to Swindler almost every day, listening, trying to find some common denominator. My territory took me up and down the coast, and I often knew of cases in other cities, cases 200 miles away in Oregon, and I reported any disappearance that might tie in to the Seattle police. The next girl to walk away forever lived in Oregon. 19 days after Susan Rancourt vanished on May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Kathy Parks had spent an unhappy and guilt-ridden day in her room in Sackett Hall on the Oregon State University campus in Corvallis, 250 miles south of Seattle. I knew Sackett Hall. I'd lived there myself when I attended one term at OSU back in the 1950s, a huge modern dormitory complex on a campus that was then considered a cow college. Even then, when the world didn't seem to be so fraught with danger, none of us would ever go to the snack machines in the cavernous basement corridors alone at night. Kathy Parks wasn't very happy at Oregon State. She was homesick for Lafayette, California, and she'd broken up with her boyfriend who'd left for Louisiana. On May 4th, Kathy had argued in a phone call with her father, and on May 6th, she'd learned that he'd suffered a massive heart attack. Her sister had called her from Spokane, Washington, with the news of their father's coronary, and then called back some hours later to say that it looked as though he would survive. Kathy, whose major was world religions,
felt a little better after the second call, and she agreed to join some of the other residents of Sackett Hall in an exercise session in the dorm lounge. Shortly before 11, the tall, slender girl with long ash-blonde hair left Sackett Hall to meet some friends for coffee in the Student Union building. She promised her roommate she would be back within the hour. Wearing blue slacks, a navy blue top, a light green jacket, and platform sandals, she left Sackett for the last time. Kathy never made the Student Union building. Like the others, all of her possessions were left behind: her bike, clothing, cosmetics. This time, no one had seen anyone suspicious. No man with his arm in a sling. No Volkswagen bugs. Kathy had never talked of being afraid or of receiving obscene phone calls. She had been a girl so subject to wide mood swings that the question of suicide arose. Had she felt so guilty about fighting with her father, perhaps believing that she had caused his heart attack? Guilty enough to have taken her own life? The Willamette River, which wends its way near Corvallis, was dragged, and nothing was found. Had she chosen another means of self-destruction, her body would surely be located soon, but it was not. Lieutenant Bill Harris of the Oregon State Police Criminal Investigation Unit was stationed on the OSU campus, and he headed the probe in Oregon. He had had a tragic homicide in Sackett Hall a few years before, where a co-ed was found stabbed to death in her room. But his successful investigation had resulted in the arrest of a male student who lived on an upper floor. The youth was still in the Oregon State Penitentiary. After a week-long search, Harris was convinced that Kathy Parks had been abducted, probably seized as she walked between the great masses of lilac bushes blooming along the path between Sackett Hall and the Student Union building. Gone, like all the others, without a single cry for help. Police bulletins with pictures of the four missing girls were tacked up side by side on the office walls of every law enforcement agency in the Northwest, smiling faces that looked enough alike to be sisters. Yet only Herb Swindler was absolutely convinced that Kathy Parks was part of the pattern. Other detectives felt Corvallis was too far away for her to be a victim of the same man who prowled Washington campuses. There was to be only a short respite. 26 days later, a casual acquaintance of my elder daughter, Brenda Carol Ball, 22, who lived with two roommates in the South King County suburb of Burien, disappeared. Brenda had been a Highline Community College student until 2 weeks before. She was 5'3", 112 pounds, and her brown eyes sparkled with her zest for life. On the night of May 31st, June 1st, Brenda went alone to the Flame Tavern at 128th South and Ambaum Road South. Her roommates had seen her last at 2 p.m. that Friday afternoon, and she told them that she planned to go to the tavern and mentioned that she might catch a ride afterward to Sun Lake State Park in eastern Washington and meet them there. She did go to the Flame and was seen there by several people who knew her. No one remembers exactly what she was wearing, but her usual garb was faded blue jeans and long-sleeved turtleneck tops. She seemed to be having a good time and stayed until closing at 2 a.m. Brenda asked one of the musicians in the band for a ride home, but he explained he was heading in another direction. The last time anyone remembers seeing Brenda Ball, she was talking in the parking lot with a handsome brown-haired man who had one arm in a sling. Because Brenda, like Donna Manson, was a free spirit given to impulsive trips, there was a long delay before she was officially reported missing. 19 days passed before her roommates became convinced that something had happened to her. They'd checked with her bank and become alarmed when they learned that her savings account hadn't been touched. All of her clothing was still in their apartment. Her parents, who lived nearby, hadn't heard from her either. At 22, Brenda was the oldest of all the missing women, an adult who had proved herself capable and cautious in the past, but not now. It seemed that Brenda, too, had met someone she should not have trusted. Brenda was gone. But the stalking was far from over. Even before Brenda Ball was reported as a missing person to King County Police, the man law enforcement officers sought was on the prowl again, about to strike audaciously, virtually in full view of dozens of witnesses,
and still remain only a phantom figure. He would thumb his nose at police, leaving them as frustrated as they had ever been in the series of crimes that had already both galled and horrified them. Many of the detectives searching for the missing girls had daughters of their own. It was almost as if it were some kind of perverse game of challenge on the part of the abductor, as if each time he would come a little further out of the shadows, take more chances, to prove that he could do what he wanted and still not be caught or even seen. Georgianne Hawkins, at 18, was one of those golden girls for whom luck or fate had dealt a perfect hand until the inexplicable night of June 10th. Raised in the Tacoma suburb of Sumner, she'd been a daffodil princess and, like Susan Rancourt, a cheerleader, an honor student at Lakes High School. She had a vivacious, pixie-like quality to her loveliness, glossy, long brown hair and lively brown eyes. She was tiny, 5 feet 2 inches tall, 115 pounds, healthy in a glowing way, the youngest of two daughters of the Warren B. Hawkins family. While many good students in high school tend to find the University of Washington's curriculum much more difficult and drop to a comfortable C average, Georgianne had continued to maintain a straight A record. Her biggest worry during that finals week of June 1974 was that she was having a difficult time with Spanish. She considered dropping the course, but on the morning of June 10th, she had phoned her mother and said she was going to cram for the next day's final as hard as she could, and she thought she could handle it. She already had a summer job lined up, with Pierce County in Tacoma, and she discussed it by phone with her parents at least once a week. During rush week in September of 1973, Georgianne had been tapped by one of the top sororities on campus, Kappa Alpha Theta, and lived in the big house among several other Greek houses along 17th Avenue, N.E. Residents of the sororities and fraternities along Greek Row visit back and forth much more freely than they did back in the 50s, when it was strictly forbidden for members of the opposite sex to venture above the formal living rooms on the first floor. Georgianne frequently dropped in to see her boyfriend, who lived in the Beta Theta Pi house, 6 houses down from the Theta house. During the early evening hours of Monday, June 10th, Georgianne and a sorority sister had gone to a party where they'd had one or two mixed drinks. Georgianne explained that she had to get back to study for her Spanish exam, but first she was going to stop by the Beta house and say goodnight to her boyfriend. Georgianne was cautious. She rarely went anywhere on campus alone at night, but the area along 17th Avenue NE was so familiar, so well-lighted, and there was always someone around she knew. The fraternal organizations front the street on each side, with a grassy island running down the middle. Trees in full leaf in June do block out some of the street lights. They've grown so tall since they were planted back in the 20s. The alley that runs in back of the Greek houses from 45th NE to 47th NE is as bright as day, lit by street lights every 10 feet or so. June 10th was a warm night, and every window opening onto the alleyway was open. It is doubtful that any of the student residents were asleep, even at midnight. Most of them were cramming for finals with the aid of black coffee and no-dos. Georgianne did go to the Beta house a little before 12:30 a.m. on June 11th. She visited with her steady boyfriend for a half hour or so, borrowed some Spanish notes, and then said goodnight and left by the back door to walk the 90 feet down to the back door of the Theta house. One of the other Betas heard the door slam and stuck his head out his window, recognizing Georgianne.
"Hey, George," he called loudly. "What's happening?"
The pretty, deeply tanned girl wearing blue slacks, a white backless t-shirt, and a sheer red, white, and blue top craned her neck and looked back. She smiled and waved, talked for a moment or two about the Spanish exam, and then laughing called, "Adios." She turned and headed south toward her residence. He watched her for about 30 feet. Two other males called that they saw her traverse the next 20 feet. She had 40 feet to go, 40 feet in the alley brightly lit. Certainly there were some murky areas between the big houses, filled with laurel hedges, blooming rhododendrons, but Georgianne would have stayed in the middle of the alley. Her roommate, Dee Nichols, waited for the familiar sound of pebbles hitting their window. Georgianne had lost her key to the back door, and the sorority sister would have to run down the stairs and let her in. There was no rattling of pebbles. There was no sound, no outcry, nothing. An hour passed, 2 hours. Worried, Dee called the Beta House and learned Georgianne had left for home a little after 1 a.m. She awoke the house mother and said softly, "Georgianne's gone. She didn't come home." They waited through the night, trying to find some reasonable explanation for why Georgianne might be gone, not wanting to alarm her parents at 3 a.m. In the morning, they called the Seattle police. Detective Bud Gelberg of the Missing Persons Unit took the report and rechecked with the fraternity house where she'd been seen last, then called her parents. Usually, any police department will wait 24 hours before beginning a search for a missing adult, but in view of the events of the first half of 1974, the disappearance of Georgianne Hawkins was treated very, very seriously immediately. At 8:45 a.m., Detective Sergeant Ivan Beeson and Detectives Ted Fonis and George Cuthill of the Homicide Unit arrived at the Theta House, 4521 17th NE. They were accompanied by George Ishii, one of the most renowned criminalists in the Northwest. Ishii, who heads the Western Washington State Crime Lab, is a brilliant man, a man who probably knows more about the detection, preservation, and testing of physical evidence than any other criminalist in the western half of the United States. He was my first teacher of crime scene investigation. In two quarters, I learned more about physical evidence than I ever had before. Ishii believes implicitly in the theories of Dr. E. Locard, a pioneer French criminalist who states, "Every criminal leaves something of himself at the scene of a crime, something, no matter how minute, and always takes something of the scene away with him." Every good detective knows this. This is why they search so intensely at a crime scene for that small part of the perpetrator that he has left behind. A hair, a drop of blood, a thread, a button, a finger or palm print, a footprint, traces of semen, tool marks, shell casings. And in most instances, they find it. The criminalist and the three homicide detectives covered that alleyway behind 45th and 47th NE, that 90 feet, on their hands and knees, and found nothing at all. Leaving the alley cordoned off and guarded by patrolmen, they went into the Theta House to talk with Georgianne's sorority sisters and her house mother. Georgianne lived in number 8 in the house, a room she shared with Dean Nichols. All of her possessions were there, everything but the clothes she'd been wearing and her leather purse, a tan sack bag with reddish stains on it. In that purse, she had carried her ID, a few dollars, a bottle of heaven-sent perfume with angels on the label, and a small hairbrush.
"Georgianne never went anyplace without leaving me the phone number where she'd be," Dee said. "I know she intended to come back here last night. She had one more exam, and then she was going home for the summer on the 13th. The blue slacks, the one she was wearing, were missing 3 buttons. There was only one left. I can give you one of the buttons like it from our room."
Like Susan Rancourt, Georgianne was very myopic.
"She wasn't wearing her glasses or her contacts last night," her roommate recalled. "She'd worn her contacts all day to study, and after you've worn contact lenses for a long time, things look blurry when you put your glasses on, so she wasn't wearing them either."
The missing girl could have seen well enough to negotiate the familiar alley, but she would have seen nothing more than a vague outline of a figure more than 10 feet away. If someone had been lurking in the alley, someone who had learned Georgianne's name after hearing the youth call to her from the Beta House window, he could easily have used a soft, "George," to call her close to him. And she would have had to walk very close indeed in order to recognize the man who beckoned to her. Perhaps so close that she could have been seized, gagged, and carried off before she had a chance to cry out? Surely anyone looking down the alley would have been alerted at the sight of a man carrying her away. Or would they? There are always hijinks during finals week, anything to break the tension, and strong young men frequently pick up giggling, squealing girls playing caveman. But no one had seen even that. Georgianne Hawkins may have been knocked out with one blow, chloroformed, injected with a swift-acting nervous system depressant, her just pinioned and powerful arms, a hand held tightly over her mouth so that she couldn't even scream.
She was afraid of the dark, Dee said quietly. Sometimes we would walk all the way around a block just to avoid a dark spot along the sidewalk. When he got her, I know that she was hurrying back here. I don't think she had a chance.
The sorority sister who had attended the party earlier in the evening with Georgianne remembered that they parted on the corner of 47th NE and NE 17th.
She stood and waited while I walked to our house, and I yelled to her that I was okay, and she yelled back that she was okay. All of us kind of checked on each other like that. She went into the Beta house, and that's the last time I ever saw her.
It was incomprehensible then, and it is still incomprehensible to Seattle homicide detectives, that Georgianne Hawkins could vanish so completely within a space of 40 feet. Of all the cases of missing girls, it is the Hawkins case that baffles them the most. It was something that couldn't have happened, and yet it did. When the news of Georgianne's disappearance hit the media, two witnesses came forward with stories of incidents on June 11th that were amazingly similar. An attractive sorority girl said that she'd been walking in front of the Greek houses on 17th NE at about 12:30 a.m. when she'd seen a young man on crutches just ahead of her. One leg of his jeans had been cut up the side, and he appeared to have a full cast on that leg.
He was carrying a briefcase with a handle, and he kept dropping it. I offered to help him, but I told him I had to go into one of the houses for a few minutes, and if he didn't mind waiting, I'd come out and help him get his stuff home.
And did you?
No, I was inside longer than I thought, and he was gone when I came out.
A male college student also had seen the tall, good-looking man with the briefcase and crutches.
A girl was carrying his case for him, and later on, after I'd taken my girl home, I saw the girl again walking alone.
He looked at a picture of Georgianne Hawkins, but said he was positive she wasn't the girl he'd seen. At this time, the notation in the Susan Rancourt file in Ellensburg about the man with his arm in a sling was not generally known. Only after publicity about the man with his leg in the cast was disseminated would the two incidents so far apart be coordinated. Coincidence? Or part of a sly plan to throw young women off guard? Detectives canvassed every house on each side of 17th NE. At the Phi Sigma Sigma fraternity at 4520, just across from the Theta house, they found that the house mother recalled being awakened from a sound sleep between 1 and 2 on the morning of June 11th.
It was a scream that wakened me. It was a high-pitched scream, a terrified scream. And then it just stopped and everything was quiet. I figured it was just kids horsing around. But now I wish I'd...
No one else heard it. Linda, Donna, Susan, Kathy, Brenda, Georgianne. All gone as completely as if a seam in the backdrop of life itself had opened, drawn them in, and closed without leaving so much as a mended tear in the tapestry. Georgianne Hawkins' father, his voice breaking, summed up the feelings of all the desperately worried parents who waited for some word.
Every day I'm a little bit lower. You'd like to hope, but I'm too realistic. She was a very friendly, very involved youngster. I keep saying was. I shouldn't say that. It's a job raising kids. You steer them along, and we figured we had both our kids over the hump.
Any homicide detective who has ever tried to cope with the anguish of parents who realize intuitively that their children are dead, but have not even the faint comfort of knowing where their bodies are, can attest to the fact that this is the worst. One weary investigator commented to me,
"It's rough. It's damn rough when you have to tell them that you found a body, that it's their kid. But it's never over for the parents who just don't know. They can't really have a funeral. They can't know that their children aren't being held and tortured someplace. They can't face their grief and get it over. Hell, you never get over it, but if you know, you can pick your life up again somehow."
The girls were gone, and each set of parents tried to deal with it, brought in the records that would mean the identification one day, perhaps, of a decomposed body. Dental records, all the years of paying for fillings and orthodontics so that their daughters would have good teeth to last a lifetime. The x-rays from Donna Manson's broken bones, set clean and strong again. And for Georgianne, X-rays taken when she'd suffered from Osgood Schlatter's disease as a teenager, an inflammation of the tibia near the knee. After months of concern, her legs had grown long and shapely, marked only by slight bumps just below the knee. Any of us who have raised children know, as John F. Kennedy once said, that to have children is to give hostages to fate. To lose a child to an illness or even an accident can be dealt with during the passage of time. To lose a child to a predator, an insanely brilliant killer, is almost more than any human should have to bear. When I began writing fact detective stories, I promised myself that I would always remember I was writing about the loss of human beings, that I was never to forget that. I hoped that the work I did might somehow save other victims, might warn them of the danger. I never wanted to become tough, to seek out the sensational and the gory, and I never have. I have joined the Committee of Friends and Families of Missing Persons and Victims of Violent Crimes at the invitation of the group. I have met many parents of victims, cried with them, and yet I have somehow felt guilty because I make my living from other people's tragedies. When I told the committee how I felt, they put their arms around me and said, "No, keep on writing. Let the public know how it is for us. Let them know how we hurt, how we try to save other parents' children by working for new legislation that requires mandatory sentencing and the death penalty for killers." They are far stronger than I could ever be. And so I kept on, trying to find the answer to the awful puzzle, believing that the killer, when he was found, would prove to be a man with a record of violence, a man who should never have been allowed to walk the streets, someone who must surely have shown signs of a deranged mind in the past, someone who had been let out of prison too soon. Chapter 9. I happened to be sitting in Captain Herb Swindler's office one afternoon in late June of 1974, when Joni Lenz and her father came into the homicide unit. Herb had a montage of the victims' pictures on his wall. He kept them there as a reminder that the investigation must continue with no let-up in intensity. Joni had volunteered to come in and look at the other girls' pictures to see if she recognized any of them, even though their names were completely unfamiliar to her.
"Joni," Herb said gently, "look at these girls. Have you ever seen any of them? Maybe you've been in a club together, worked together, had a class or something with them."
With her father standing protectively beside her, the victim of the January 4th bludgeoning studied the photographs. The slender girl was still recovering from the brain damage she'd suffered, and she spoke with a hesitancy, a vagueness, but she was trying very hard to help. She moved closer to the wall, studied each photo carefully, and then she shook her head.
"No, she stuttered. "I never saw them. I didn't know them. I can't remember. A lot of things I can't remember, but I know I never knew the girls."
"Thank you, Joni," Herb said. "We appreciate your coming in."
It had been a long shot, the slight possibility that the one living victim would prove to be a link. Herb glanced at me and shook his head as Joni Lenz limped out of the room. If she had known any of the others, so much of her memory of the past year had been battered out of her brain cells. Now, in the early summer of 1974, the reading public knew of the pattern of missing girls. It was no longer a matter that concerned only detectives and the principals involved. And the public was terrified. Hitchhiking among young women dropped sharply, and women from 15 to 65 jumped at shadows. Stories began, the kind of stories that can never be traced directly to the source. I heard variations on the same theme a dozen times, but they always came from a friend of a friend of a friend of someone whose cousin or sister or wife had been involved. Sometimes the attacks were said to have happened in a shopping mall, sometimes in a restaurant, sometimes a theater. It went like this. This man and his wife, or sister, daughter, etc., went to South Center Mall to shop, and she went back to their car to get something. Well, she didn't come back for a long time, and he got worried and went looking for her. He got there just in time to see some guy carrying her away. The husband yelled, and the guy dropped her. He'd given her some kind of shot that made her pass out. It was really lucky that he got there in time because, you know, with everything that's been happening, it was probably that killer.
The first few times I heard versions of the true story, I attempted to trace it back to its origin, but I found it was impossible to do so. I doubt that any of the incidents ever happened at all. It was the reaction of the public, mass hysteria. If the girls who were gone could disappear the way they had, then anyone could, and there seemed to be no way to prevent it. The pressure on law enforcement, of course, was tremendous. On July 3rd, more than 100 representatives from departments all over Washington and Oregon met in Olympia at Evergreen State College for a day-long brainstorming conference. Perhaps if they pooled their information, they might find the common denominator that would break the seemingly inscrutable mysteries. I was invited to attend and felt a kind of eerie oppressiveness as I walked along the fur-shrouded paths to the conference. Donna Manson had walked here 4 months before, headed for the same building. Now the rains had given way to bright sunshine, and the birds called from the trees above me, but the feeling of dread was still there. Sitting among the investigators from the Seattle Police Department, the King County Police Department, the Washington State Patrol, the U.S. Army CID, the University of Washington Police, the Central Washington Security Force, the Tacoma Police Department, the Pierce County Sheriff's Office, the Multnomah, Oregon County Sheriff's Department, the Oregon State Police, and dozens of smaller police departments, I found it almost impossible to believe that all these men, with scores upon scores of years of training and experience, could not find out more about the suspect they sought. It was not from lack of trying. Every single department involved wanted him, and they were willing to explore any avenue, no matter how bizarre, to accomplish an arrest, a good arrest that would stick. Sheriff Don Redmond of Thurston County summed up the feeling in his opening remarks.
"We want to show parents we really care. We want to find their children. The people of the state of Washington are going to have to give us a hand. So many times people could volunteer information. We need the eyes and ears of the people out there."
Redmond's department, located in Washington's outskirts of Donna Manson. Now they had another homicide of a teenager to contend with. Brenda Baker had been 15 years old, a hitchhiker like Kathy and Donna, and she'd run away from home on May 25th. On June 17th, her badly decomposed body was found at the edge of Miller Sylvania State Park. It was too late to determine cause of death or to make a quick identification. At first, it was thought that it might have been the body of Georgianne Hawkins. Dental charts proved, however, that it was Brenda Baker. The Baker girl's body was found several miles away from McKinney Park, where Kathy Devine had been found. However, both sites were the same distance from I-5, the freeway that runs between Seattle and Olympia. Looking at the cases of the missing girls side by side, some striking similarities could not be ignored. It was as if the man who'd taken them away had chosen a certain type he wanted, picked his quarry with care. Each had long hair, parted in the middle. Each was Caucasian, fair-complexioned. Each was of much more than average intelligence. Each was slender, attractive, highly talented. Each had vanished within a week of midterm or final exams at local colleges. Each came from a stable, loving family. Each disappearance took place during the hours of darkness. Each girl was single. Each girl had been wearing slacks or jeans when she disappeared. In each case, detectives had not one piece of physical evidence that might have been left by the abductor. Construction work was going on each campus where the girls were missing. And in two instances, Susan Rancourt in Ellensburg and Georgianne Hawkins in Seattle, a man wearing a cast on his arm or leg had been seen close to where they had vanished. They were all young girls. None of them could be considered a mature woman. It was weird, perverted, insane, and for the detectives trying to get a fix on the man, akin to working their way through a maze, starting up each new path only to find it blocked. The victims certainly did not appear to have been selected by random choice, and they wondered about that. They even wondered if it might not be more than one man they were seeking, a cult choosing maidens to be sacrificed in deadly rituals. During that spring of 1974,
A rash of reports had come in from northwestern states on the mutilation of cattle, found in fields with only their sexual organs missing. All this smacked of devil worship. The natural or unnatural progression of such mutilations would be human sacrifice. For the detectives gathered at Evergreen College, all men whose work and lifestyles made them think in rational, concrete terms, the occult was a foreign concept. I believe in the efficacy of ESP, but I was most certainly not conversant with astrology beyond reading the daily syndicated columns. However, I had had a phone call a few days before that Olympia conference and a meeting with a woman who was an astrologer. My friend, who uses the initials RL when she charts astrology, is a woman who had worked at the crisis clinic while I did. In her late 30s, she was in her senior year at the University of Washington as a history major. I had not heard from her in some time when she'd called in late June.
"Anne, you're close to the police," she began. "I found something that I think they should know about. Could we talk?"
I met with RL in her North End apartment, and she led me to her office where the desk, floors, and furniture were buried in charts with strange symbols. She had been trying to find a pattern, an astrological pattern in the case of the missing girls.
"I've come across something. Look at these," she said.
I was completely at a loss. I could make out my sign, Libra scales, but the rest was only so much scribbling to me. I told her so.
"Okay, I'll give you a crash course. You probably know about the sun signs. There are 12 and last approximately a month each year. That's what people mean when they say I'm an Aquarian or a Scorpio, etc. But the moon passes through each of these signs every month."
She showed me an ephemeris, an astrological almanac, and I could see that the phases of the moon sign seemed to last about 48 hours each month.
"All right, I understand that much, but I can't see what it has to do with the cases," I argued. "There's a pattern. Linda Healy was taken when the moon was going through a Taurus phase. From that point on, the girls vanished alternately in Pisces and Scorpio moon phases. The chances against that happening, the odds, are almost impossible."
"You think someone is deliberately abducting those girls, maybe killing them because he knows the moon is going through a certain sign? I can't comprehend that."
"I don't know if he knows anything about astrology," she said. "He might not even be aware of the forces of the moon."
She pulled out a sealed envelope.
"I want you to give this to someone who's in charge. It's not to be opened until after the weekend of July 13th to 15th.
"Come on, they'd laugh me out of their offices."
"What else do they have to go on?
I've seen this pattern. I've worked it out several times, and there it is. If I could tell you who or where or when it's going to happen again, I would, but I can't do that. It's happened once when the moon was in Taurus, and then a half dozen times back and forth between Pisces and Scorpio. I think he's going to go back to Taurus and start a new cycle." "All right," I finally said. "I'll take the envelope, but I won't promise I'll give it to anyone. I don't know who I could give it to."
"You'll find someone," she said firmly.
I had that envelope in my purse as I attended the law enforcement conference at Evergreen. I was still undecided about mentioning it or the predictions of RL. Herb Swindler took over the lectern after the lunch break. He threw out a startling question and drew some guffaws from his fellow lawmen.
"Anybody have any ideas? Is there some pattern coming down that we haven't considered? Anybody here know anything about numerology? Anybody psychic?"
I figured Herb was kidding, but he wasn't. He began to write on the blackboard, listing the dates of the girls' disappearances in an attempt to find a numerological link. But there seemed to be nothing that could be called a pattern. From Linda's disappearance to Donna's, there had been a 42-day interim. From Donna's to Susan's, 36 days. From Susan's to Kathy Park's, 19 days. From Kathy's to Brenda's, 25 days. And from Brenda's to Georgianne's, 11 days. The only thing immediately apparent was that the abductions were getting closer and closer together.
"Okay," Herb said. "Any other suggestions? I don't care how crazy it might sound, we'll kick it around."
The letter was burning a hole in my purse. I raised my hand. "I haven't heard anything about numerology, but my friend, an astrologer, says there's an astrological pattern." There were some eyes raised to the ceiling, some chuckles, but I plunged ahead, explaining what R.L. had told me.
He's only taking the girls away when the moon is moving through Taurus, Pisces, or Scorpio.
Your friend thinks this is unusual? Swindler smiled.
She says it defies the laws of probability.
Then she can tell us when it might happen again?
I'm not sure. She gave me a sealed envelope. You can have it if you like. You're not to open it until July 15th.
I could sense that my audience was getting restless, that they thought we were wasting time. I passed the envelope up to Herb, and he waited in his hand.
So she thinks that's the next time a girl's going to vanish, does she?
I don't know. I don't know what's in that envelope. She wants to test her theory, and she only said not to open the letter until then.
The discussion moved into other areas. I suspected that most of the investigators present thought I was a crazy reporter, and I wasn't too sure myself that it wasn't really reaching to make a pattern where there was none. The general consensus of opinion was that it was only one man who was responsible for the girls vanishing, and we were trying to figure out what ruse he could use that would put the women at ease enough so that they would drop their natural caution. Who would most young women trust automatically? What guise could he have assumed that would make them feel he was safe? Since childhood, most of us have been trained to believe we can trust a minister, a priest, a fireman, a doctor, ambulance attendant, and a policeman. The last thought was one that couldn't be overlooked, abhorrent as it was to these men who were policemen themselves. A rogue cop, maybe? Or someone in a policeman's uniform? The next safe assumption was that most young women would have helped a handicapped person. A blind man, someone taken suddenly ill, someone on crutches or in a cast. So what do? Infiltrate every campus in the Northwest with policemen? Tell them to stop every man who's